Well, this morning, you'll be very aware, we've promoted this Easter around the idea of freedom. All our signs and advertising and so on has been along that idea. We've done it, although we could certainly have been more direct and simply said on our signs, "He is risen." That would be straightforward. That's the event we're celebrating. It's a statement that Christians have been making at Easter time for centuries. We've been saying to each other, "He is risen," and had the response regularly, "He is risen indeed," and it's been something that we have shared together from the very first, that kind of encouragement of one another, that this is a true statement, this is a thing that has happened. The problem with that statement, though, "He is risen," is it's lost its meaning. Freedom still resonates, but the statement, "Jesus is risen," it's largely been reduced to a kind of metaphor for new start, refresh, renew, and nothing more than that, which is shocking and tragic, because if that claim, which is the central claim of the Christian faith, were understood as it was originally intended, "He is risen," we would rightly expect it to be on the front page of every newspaper across the land. "He is risen," with the consequences that flow. It's an astonishing thing. You'd expect every news station to be leading with it through its bulletins. "He is risen." It would change everything. You know, the claim of the Christian faith is unique among the religions, and it's worth just continually coming at this one. Religions are all the same. I mean, it's one of those popular things it's true. They're all the same, but they deal with the same issues. They deal with the issues of life after death, what life is about, what's the meaning and purpose of life, is there a God, how we got here. These big issues, religions are all the same. But in terms of how they answer the questions of life, they are very, very different. And the Christian faith is unique, chalk and cheese, in that it alone makes this astonishing claim that in the work of one man, death itself, the one great certainty that we've been bound by from the beginning, has gone. Not in some kind of wishful dream or longing, but in fact, in flesh, blood and bone fact. Death has been defeated. The horrific wall at the end of our life that ends life and destroys everything and cuts us off from existence and enslaves us has gone. It's finished. It's been smashed down to open up a genuine certainty of eternal life, an existence that will go on. He is risen. It's an astonishing thing to say. It's a declaration not just that a man was resuscitated, but that a particular man, as a representative of humanity, broke through death, came back to life again, never to die again, came back as a whole new being, a human for a new age. And by that rising, has created an opportunity, not just in a spiritual sense, not just as a metaphor for the footy team that was down that can now come back, the person in a depressed state that can actually have a renewed life, not just as a metaphor, but as a fact. He came back so that death itself is over. Now, the problem, though, with that headline, "He is risen," is that very few people hear any of that in it. Very few people appreciate the astonishing nature of the claim, partly, I suspect, because we've been used to hearing it from churches that are so wet and woolly and have been saying wet and woolly things for years. We just think it's another wet and woolly thing, and they put it up on signs with cutesy little things around it, and we make it just cute. We miss the significance of it. But when you go back to the source of all of this, which are the records of that first Easter event, the tone, the shape, the vibe is full of astonishment and full of fact. You know, we had read for us this morning from Luke 24, which is one of the records of this particular incident, this event. It's one account of four. We've got numbers of ancient documents that reference this same event. This one particularly has been written by a man who, we are told at the very beginning of this book, investigated everything carefully to know the certainty of these things. He wasn't simply intent on foisting a myth. He looked at it. He tells us he researched it. That's the nature of this kind of document. And what we learn from here about this event you can add together with the information we gather from other accounts and pull it all and come up with this comprehensive expression of the events on that first Sunday. In fact, that's my intention this morning, is to take you through the comprehensive character of what actually occurred, what these reports all fill to tell us and point us towards. I'm going to do it from Luke, but add in the other information. Have a look with me, chapter 24. It's in your EV News. Pull it out if you've never looked at it. A part of the Bible that goes back 2,000 years. On the first day of the week, that Sunday, very early in the morning, around dawn, before dawn, it's probably that they left before the light had come up and arrived at around dawn with the light first arriving, which gives sense of why the different accounts have that kind of time scale to it. These women, we are actually told in other accounts, there were three of them. I'll tell you who they were. Mary Magdalene, another Mary, a Mary who is the wife of Cleopas, who we'll hear from in a moment actually, Salome, the third woman, who is the wife of a man called Zebedee. Now Zebedee and Salome were the parents of, do you remember who they were parents of? James and John, two of the disciples of the Lord Jesus. And it seems Zebedee was, they were fishermen. They had a fishing business that appears in the north, Galilee, but very likely had some business connections down into Jerusalem because their son, John, knew many of the high officials in Jerusalem. We get that from other accounts. But these three women, Mary Magdalene, another Mary, Salome, go to the tomb very early, around dawn, just before dawn. They find when they arrive, verse 2, the stone rolled away from the tomb. And they find when they enter, verse 3, the body of Jesus gone. Here is the central fact of Christianity. Here is what sets it apart from every other religion. It's grounded in history, not just someone's vision, not just someone's dream and wishful thought, but in the claim of history that a body is no longer there. The tomb is empty. And it's not empty, the tomb, in some merely metaphorical sense. It's rather that the body is gone, literally. Everyone at the time agreed with this. The believers, of course, agree with it, but the people who were opposed to the Christian faith agreed that there was no body there. The tomb is empty, the body is gone. Now, what do you make of that? You need to make some sense of it. In history, it's a point of fact. No one had pilgrimages to the tomb to visit the body. It wasn't part of the early Christian years. In fact, it was so much not part of the early Christian years that we don't actually know exactly where the body was anymore because no one went to it, no one made anything of it except here it is, it's empty. The body is gone. Now, they themselves didn't know what to make of it. Their first thought wasn't resurrection. Look at verse 4. While they were wondering about this, this wasn't a group of women who arrived at the tomb and went, oh, body's gone, resurrection. Remember that last one we saw too? You know, like they were this gullible bunch of primitives. They wondered about this. Now, at this point, other accounts tell us that Mary Magdalene takes off to tell Peter and John, who were staying probably at John's parents' house, which was less than a kilometre away from the tomb. The other women go a step further. They enter the tomb, and there they're confronted by two men, messengers, who give words to make sense of these events. They say, verse 5, why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here, he is risen. Remember how he told you while he was still with you in Galilee. The Son of Man must be delivered over to the hands of sinners, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again. Here are some words to make sense of what's happening, and the words take them back to this was no accident. Jesus had prepared you for this. This was something that was purposed and planned. In verse 8, they remember. Verse 9, these messengers then tell them that they're to go back and tell the other 11 the things that have occurred. Now, when you end in Mark's account of these events, it appears that they didn't immediately do that. For very good reason. What appears is that having gone through the experience of the crucifixion, seeing their Lord crucified in the most barbaric and ugly, shameful fashion possible, they then go to the tomb early in the morning to embalm this body that was the one of their great hope, to find it gone and the tomb empty with messengers. they're in shock, it seems. And Mark's account tells us that they roamed very likely through the early dawn, early 6-7 o'clock morning marketplace beginning to set up, full of people beginning to crowd into what was just another normal day without saying anything to anyone. They roamed through that region dumbstruck. Now, we're not exactly sure what happens next, but there is a clue in this account that we're looking at that suggests a fair guess. Have a look at chapter 24, verse 10. It was Mary Magdalene, the one we've already had mention of, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and others with them who told this to the apostles. Now, who is Joanna? She wasn't at the tomb. There's no evidence to suggest that she was there at all. The other accounts don't mention her in that context. Who is this woman? Well, Luke himself tells us, some chapters earlier in chapter 8, he tells us that there were a number of women who were following Jesus, who were helping fund his ministries out of their own pockets. And we're actually told that she was one of these women. And we're told a little bit more information about her. Joanna was the wife of a man called Chuza, who we're told was the manager of Herod's household. Who is Herod? Herod is the ruler of the Galilean portion of Palestine, where Jesus was had grown up and had been operating, and these women were all part of that area, Herod Antipas. Now, over the Passover, Herod Antipas, as one of the rulers, was in Jerusalem, staying at Herod's great palace, which was on the western side of the temple. Herod's there with his household at this very time, so the manager of his household chooses there with his wife, Joanna. How is all of that relevant? Well, it's very likely that these two women, coming back from the tomb, dumbstruck, shocked, puzzled, knowing they need to get to the disciples, between the tomb and the house where John and Peter and the other disciples are staying, is Joanna's residence in Herod's palace. You can imagine so easily how they drop in. 15 minutes, half an hour, pouring it all out, making sense of, debriefing together, then getting up and going to see the others. So that verse 10, it was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, the others with them who told this to the apostles. She is now with them when news is brought. Mary Magdalene is almost certainly rushed back and reported it. None of them believed. Verse 11, notice that. None of them believed, the women, because their words seemed to them like nonsense. But now you've got Mary, who is John's mother. His own mum comes and says, I was there. I've seen it. Peter, this is enough information for the two of them now to rush back to consider. Verse 12, Peter, however, gets up, runs back to the tomb, bends over, sees the strip of linen lying by themselves. He went away wondering to himself, what has happened? This is an astonishing, extraordinary experience. And then this story is confirmed, the women's story is confirmed in verse 34 by a couple of men who had been walking on the road to Emmaus. If you look there, though, you'll find in verse 18, one of the men is a man called Cleopas, who is the husband of the other Mary. It's an astonishing series of connections. These confirm that this has in fact happened because they see Jesus alive. Verse 34, it is true, the Lord has risen. He has appeared to Simon. Then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread. They're still struggling, verse 40, to make sense of it all. Jesus himself climactically seals it when he stands among them. And although they are slow to get it, they're frightened, they're startled. Verse 37, he shows them the physical wounds and then takes something to eat, verse 42, and eats it in their presence. There are the events. Now, whatever you make of this, it isn't simply a parable about fresh starts. It isn't a metaphor for how to have renewal in the life that's struggling. There are too many evidences that what we're dealing with here with is factual eyewitness accounts of concrete historic events. Let me take you through some of them. The sense of astonishment that is all the way through. They don't just suddenly believe it because someone says something. At every step, they're slow. And we're told that they're slow. Why? Because someone coming back from the dead as a resurrection did not ever happen. It's an astonishing, unique event that they didn't anticipate. They had to be reminded that Jesus had said this would happen. It wasn't their wishful thinking that it would be so. They were far from expecting it. They knew that dead people don't come back to life. And so the sense of astonishment and struggle to believe is so close to the truth of how we would be. The physical nature of Jesus' appearances. He shows them his wounds and he eats with them. He says, "This is no dream. This is no spirit body. This is real." The fact that it's the women who are first to report this. Now get this, this is not me, 21st century person, saying this, but back in the first century, women weren't regarded as reliable witnesses for anything. And so in a court case, you couldn't bring women to bear as part of the confirmation of something that had occurred. Now what is astonishing here is that this record and each of the records tell us that the witnesses, the first witnesses, were women. If you're a first century leader who wanted to foist on the world a myth and fabricated this story together in collusion with others, you would never start the story with women having witnessed the scene. The grave clothes are still there. The body's gone, but the expensive cloth is not. Now think, a grave robber, he's robbing the grave and he would leave the most expensive part behind. The disciples stealing the body in a rush, unwrap it and leave the cloth there? None of this fits. The different appearances, there's so many and varied. Jesus appears to one person, he appears to two people, he appears to a group of people, he appears to 500 at once. He appears early in the morning, he appears lunchtime, he appears late, he appears north, he appears south. He appears indoors, outdoors, by a lake. There are too many different varied appearances to be explained away by hallucinations. Hallucinations don't work in those many different varied contexts. Sixthly, the dovetailing of details. This itself is one of those remarkable things that you need to experience for yourself by reading the accounts. In that we're not told... Do you know, we're not told about Salome and how she's connected with and Mary and the other Mary and how none of the reporters make anything of these things. But it's as you read the different accounts, what you find it's so well dovetailed that you actually are driven to the conclusion that what you have here is innocent, straightforward attempts to communicate the most extraordinary news humanity has ever had to deal with. This is just what happened. It was Salome. Joanna ended up there. Death has been destroyed, and they wanted to tell us as closely as they could to the facts of the events. You know, it's also astonishing, why didn't EV Church just simply lead with that in its promotion? He is risen. Because there's been so much water under the bridge, it just gets lost. People just hear it as a metaphor for renewal. Freedom, however, now we get that. We get that because we're Australians. Just change gear with me and think about freedom for a moment. We're Australians, we get freedom, it's part of who we are. It's actually part of our national psyche. It's built into our national song or national anthem, Waltzing Matilda, depending on how your view is on these things. But Waltzing Matilda, just think with me about that song. Why did the swagman jump in the billabong? Oh, think about the song. Why did he jump in the billabong? "You'll never take me alive," said he. Remember he'd stolen the jumbuck and the troopers, 1, 2, 3, had arrived. "You'll never take me alive," and he commits suicide. He jumps in the lake. What is that? Well, that's a determination that I would rather give up my life than lose my freedom. That's Australians. We steal stuff and then die. Do you know what I mean? We steal stuff and keep away from the police as much as that's who we are. It's immortalized for us, which is one of those ironies, isn't it, as this song is sung as our great kind of moment of national pride and all the kind of events that we sing it at. But that's who we are. Freedom for us is huge. We fight for it. We long for it. We resist anything that would take freedom away from us. Now, how does this connect to the events that we're talking about? Well, let me say something about that event and its significance. At one level, its significance ought to be obvious. And the reason I started with it, going through it all, is so that its significance would not be lost. Do you know, on TV last year, there was the Q&A, that ABC show. They did a massive special where it was during the week where they had the Week of Dangerous Ideas, the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. And they had a panel, normally have a panel, but this panel they had Jermaine Greer, Dan Savage, a gay activist. They had Peter Hitchens and a few others. Peter Hitchens is, incidentally, he's the brother of Christopher Hitchens, who's died recently, but Christopher Hitchens was the great proponent of new atheism, has written many books and engaged in many debates about atheism. Peter Hitchens is a wonderfully converted Christian living in the United Kingdom who is very active in seeking to express that his brother's views were wrong and sadly mistaken. But Peter Hitchens was the token conservative Christian on the panel in a very hostile audience and context. The panel was given a question, and the question was, what is the most dangerous idea that we can be given? One of the panelists had to have time to think about that. Peter Hitchens jumped straight in and said, the resurrection of Jesus. If the resurrection of Jesus is true, it changes everything. It changes life in its entirety. You know, the materialistic theory of life, the view of life that all we are is matter. We are born, we eat, we sleep, we die, we work, we marry, we die, it's all over. That kind of theory of life that when you die, it's all finished and there's nothing beyond and you just rot into the grave, that materialistic vision, shattered. If one man has risen from the grave, not just resuscitated, but resurrected, never to die again. It means that you can write all your books, you can play with your philosophy, you can talk about all your dreams and ideas about the materialistic vision, but all it takes is one man to come back from the grave, gone, shattered. If Jesus has been raised, everything is different. Get that. This life is not it. And to live life as if this life is all there is, and I'm going to put it as crassly as I can because it needs to be expressed crassly, to live life as if this life is all there is the most foolish, stupid thing you could ever do. And most particularly, it means the God that Jesus spoke of is real, and we will stand before him. That changes everything. And it ties us into the freedom idea that we're talking about. You see, the resurrection secures so many critical truths. It secures the future, that there is a life beyond the grave. It secures God and his purposes and what he's about. And it secures this. It secures the fact that meeting with that God won't go well without the freedom that Jesus wins. That's so important. Let me say it again. The resurrection secures this truth, that a meeting with God won't go well unless you have the freedom that Jesus secures. You know, as I talk with people about these things, and I talk to lots of people about these things, not just because it's my job, but because I'm convinced that we need to think about these things. I talk with people who don't go to church. I talk with friends who aren't followers of Jesus. I talk with lots of people. And I keep finding a similar theme that comes up that underlies all of our conversations. It's very interesting, and you might have found the same thing, but I hear often a great reluctance amongst people I talk to bother about the things of Christianity, a great reluctance to even explore and seek to understand the claims of Christianity. I find a great reluctance to even pursue anything. And underneath it, as I dig, why are you reluctant? Why are you reluctant? What's really fueling this reluctance? Underneath it, one of the key things I find that keeps being expressed is the conviction that even if it's all true and there is a God, I'll be okay. Even if you're right and Jesus is who he says he is and there's a life beyond and I'll stand before God, I'll be okay. Now that conviction means that I don't need to fuss with trying to find it all out because even if it is true, it won't matter too much anyway. That is the great lie of life. And the message of the Bible and the facts of our life actually, the fact of death, tells us that it's a lie. Tells us that it won't be okay. Please let me unpack this for a moment. See, death is terrible. The only very kind of naive or people who have worked hard to persuade themselves otherwise believe that it's not okay, that it's okay. Death is a terrible horror. It's a dreadful thing. But it's much more than merely the end of life. In fact, what it is the just penalty that God has given because our lives aren't okay. It's the just penalty that God has given because our lives aren't okay. Now, here we're stepping into deep issues. But the fact is, we have chosen throughout our lives to live our lives with God as at best an optional extra, someone that we just fit in around the edges as we've got time, as we give him time. At best, we live life like that. At worst, we dismiss him out of hand as irrelevant. His response to this is to speak of his grief at that, his pain, his hurt, and his anger. It's not okay. And so he brings the just judgment upon us, the penalty, in that he limits our life and brings it to an end. He brings death. He binds us to this thing called death. And so the consequences more fully than that are that we're now locked into futility. With death as being rampant, as death as being certain, we are locked into a futility that means that we can build whatever we like to build and try and gain as much as we gain, but death will always steal it from us. We can seek to amass whatever we want to try and make life, but death will always take it. You know, at least we can build a family that will live on, but we'll be taken, they'll be taken, we'll all be taken. Death goes. Whatever we build, whatever we seek to gain, it will be undone. It's like this great container called life that we try and fill it with meaning and purpose to try and add more into it, but there's this massive hole being cut in the bottom of it called death that just floods everything out again. And so fill in as we want, it keeps being drained away. Death ends it all. And we've been locked into this. We've been subjected to it. We've been enslaved to this futility, to the life that's no bigger than me. Now, that's not the way we think about it typically. When we think of throwing off God, we think of that as finding freedom, finally. In fact, we think of freedom as the absence of the authority of God. If I can just get rid of authority over me, then I'll be free. The path to freedom for us, in our thinking, is to get rid of God, the external authority, and the more that we're rid of these authorities outside of us, the freer we'll be. For us, getting rid of constraint is the way to be free, and the rule of God is a massive constraint. But here again, we've blown it. Here again, we've misconceived things. We thought we were wise, but we become so foolish. Now, this takes some care, but think with me. We imagine that the thing holding us from freedom is the authority that God has outside of us, constraining us. We chafe under it, and so we throw it off. But we end up subjecting ourselves to a worse kind of slavery, slavery to self, slavery to futility. Let me illustrate this. Think boating. I love boating. I used to love sailing, but my parents went and sold the boat. But think with me sailing for a moment. You know, one of the great things about sailing is you go somewhere. You choose a destination. Wonderful destination is your option. So Tahiti, awesome destination. But have you ever thought about this? Once you choose a destination somewhere to go, you are suddenly constrained by that destination. You notice that? It becomes an authority. That is to say, you know, I veer off course and I'm now wrong. I'm going wrong. I better correct my course and come back to the right course to be getting to Tahiti. So it becomes a constraint over my direction, life, purpose, meaning, what I'm about. It becomes an authority that rules me. But it's a good authority, so I don't mind it. Yeah? It's getting me somewhere wonderful, so I don't mind being... But think about someone in the boat who says, look, I'm sick of being constrained by an external authority that keeps telling us we're wrong and we're right, and let's set the authority to be within the boat. No longer constrained by something out there. We'll make the goal in the boat. Now, the great consequence of that is you can never miss the goal because it's always with you wherever you go. You never have to be constrained again because no one actually can tell you what it's always just here. And so, but you know the cost? You go nowhere and you end up circling in around upon yourself. You end up being drawn back and forward towards yourself more and more. When we throw off God, the one outside of us, the one who's calling us to himself, which is Tahiti, calling us to a goal that is to know the living Creator, to have a relationship with the God of love, the goal that is a good goal, when we throw that off and we make ourselves the authority, the goal, the purpose, our only self, only ourself becomes the mark, life spirals in on itself. The only rule becomes my desires. The only authority becomes my passions and what I want. But then I become ruled by the most fickle authority, which is my desire and my passion that's up and down, and I'm driven by it, and I become self-absorbed, focused on self. And with the added sentence of death that God has brought as the penalty upon my empty life, I'm locked into futility. You know, that day, April the 5th, AD 33, the day when that man came back from the grave, not better, new, that day was the day of freedom. Because that was the day the penalty for turning from God had been removed, death. The stamp at the end of our lives that keeps saying futile, finished, nothing, is taken away. The thing that enslaved us has been destroyed. You know, if you're with us and you're a materialist and you just believe that life is matter and it just ends at death, if this is true, it's just astonishing in its own right that you could be so wrong, that there is life beyond, that materialistic vision is, that's in itself just astonishing. And please don't miss the significance of it. But for others of us, perhaps that's not been our worldview, we're wondering, why death? There's lots of things you're making claim about today. How come God brings death as a penalty? Why is that the penalty? Why does he even need to bring it? Friends, these are big issues that require lots of thought to kind of bring together the pieces. That's why we run life. We'd love to have you come along and spend some weeks hearing some information, asking questions, debating, looking at the evidence, wrestling, finding out the things that pull together to make this so astonishing. Because when you get it, it is jaw-droppingly astonishing. But why death? Why does God even have to bring death upon us? What's all that about? Let me illustrate that quickly and see if I can help give a quick taste of it. We were at the shops yesterday. Kathy and I, we were at home and I couldn't find any eggs. And so that was the end of my lunch plans, and I said, let's go out. But let's be quiet, let's not tell the kids, because they'll want to come with us and that'll make it very expensive. So let's sneak off. I mean, their kids are 5, 6, 7 and 8, they'll be all right. But we snuck off down to Terrigal to get something to eat for lunch, and I won't tell you what shop it was, and you'll see why in a moment. We went into this shop, And this young kid in front of us, he was ordering up his lunch, and it came to the final counter, and there it is sitting there, and the man says, "It'll cost you $15. And he said, "Oh, $15. He said, "Yeah, look, it's up on the board. No, $15. "Oh, I haven't got that much money. I've only got $5. He looks around, he goes, his couple of mates are over here, and he says, "You got any money?" And they go, "No, we haven't got any money." You know what my wife does? Pulls out a wallet and says, "How much do you need?" Not reluctantly. That's beautiful, isn't it? And, $10. But then the guy behind the counter goes, "Nah, look, don't worry about it. What have you got? $5. We'll just charge you that much." Now, there's two things that follow from that. First one is, how can I go shopping with Kathy all the time? Isn't that right? Because I get all the clothes and I put them on the counter, and if Kathy's with me, "Oh, I forgot my wallet." Do you know what I mean? She just pays the bill. And the second thing is, which shop was that in Terrigal? Because you can order up big and not have to pay. Do you know? Now, I have told a couple of people, keep it quiet. Just a few of us will make use of it. But friends, here's the thing. If that were the case, that there were a shop where you didn't need to pay, what would happen to ever paying? Yeah, you'd never bother taking your wallet anywhere. Now, it's a trivial example of something much more profound and big and deep. Think about the universe. If acting in betrayal, if using and hurting and abusing and acting offensively and acting in sin were never dealt with, if there were no obligations to be paid, no debt owed, what would happen to our universe? It'd be a universe that would be horrendous to live in. It'd be a universe where right and good and just disappeared as categories. What was right would be might. It would be a universe that none of us would want to live in. The God of the universe is a God of holiness and goodness and love and purity and truth. And he is a God who takes seriously that which is evil. He must act and bring penalty. And so he does. Reluctantly, but he does. But it's upon our lives that have the stamp of death that says, "My life does not measure up." But then extraordinarily, out of love, that same God pays the penalty of sin. He comes into our world in the person of his Son and absorbs into himself the just penalty that he has brought upon those that deserve it. He absorbs it himself so that that penalty can be taken away, so that at the same time he can be just and the one who justifies freely those who turn to him. And the resurrection? The resurrection all those centuries ago is evidence that the penalty has been paid. The death has been defeated. We are freed from the great power that makes everything futile. And the door to relationship with God is now open, where you can come back pardoned, free, forgiven. Now, please don't imagine in the short time I've had to mention these things that these are small things. The wonder of that event, the death of God's own Son was necessary to pay for our price. And that death was such powerful, powerful event that it unleashed a power that broke death itself and brought about his own resurrection and the resurrection of those who put their trust in him. And friends, in all of this, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, I speak to the materialist and I say the resurrection says there's life beyond. There is. But what I'm saying is, it's not just about there's a life beyond. It's a relationship thing. What I'm trying to say is that the life that's beyond is the true life, life with God, life constrained to live with him as our ruler and Lord, as the good God, loving Lord. In our foolishness, we've thought that the place of freedom was to throw him off, but we've found the lower life by that means. Whereas the higher life is actually the freedom that comes from being freed to live with him again as we were made to be. And we've had in our experience and existence this thing called death that every day says, I will not be okay with this God. I die because my life does not stack up with this God. It will not be well with me unless I receive the wonderful freedom that God establishes for me in Jesus. He has undone death itself so that we might be free to know him again, free from the emptiness of a life that's centered on itself. Now, none of this is automatic. God has done all of this for those that wake up, turn back, see where true freedom is, and put their trust in him. He's done it for you if you've done that this morning. But we want to urge you again today that it might be you if you've not yet done that. That today you might actually get some conception of the magnitude of these things and an awareness of a life that we thought was freedom that's really enslaved us, and the need to actually embrace this Jesus as our only hope of true freedom that will go on beyond the grave, that will go on forever. You know, I'm about to finish. I often reflect on those men and women who were there at the very first to see this happen, and I reflect on what their life would have been like 40 years later, say John, who was there, a witness. And I imagine him in a context where he has lost everything. He is tired, weary, beaten, battered, deserted, because he's been proclaiming this news. And I keep wondering, what's kept him going? What's enabled him to keep pressing on, even though he's got nothing? Nothing that the world has to offer, he's got nothing. What keeps him going? It's not some voice in his head. It's the conviction that what he saw was true. There is victory over death, and it's in Jesus Christ. That conviction sustained him to tell everybody he could, to believe it himself, and to declare it to anyone and everyone who would listen. So this morning I want to urge you two things. If you don't know this freedom, come and find it. It is fantastic. It goes forever. But if you do know it, don't be reluctant about sharing it. These things are too immense to live with our heads in the sand. Abbot, I pray. Our great God and Heavenly Father, we thank you that you have raised your Son, that he is risen, that death is defeated, the futility that life has been locked into has been broken open, that we can now know true freedom, the freedom of knowing you, of living with you, living for you. And pray, please, that amongst us, you would cause it to be the case that people would be amongst us, would be determined to explore the evidences for these things to find out if these things truly are true. That please, you would not let any of us be hindered from that path, to have anything in our way that would make us think it was not worth pursuing. Please give us the energy, the input, the effort to pursue these things. But for those of us who know these things to be true, we pray, please, that you would continue to stir us with deep convictions about the reality of them, that we would live therefore every day seeking to honour and please you and declare this wonderful truth to whoever would listen. And we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.